Today, how our greatest strength can lead to our greatest weaknesses, which can then finally lead to what really is our greatest strength.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Well, that's as oblique an introduction as I've done, I think. The thing I want to talk about does have a lot to do with the things we're best at and how we improve about those things and how we see the weaknesses in our own life and think about those things and our relationships with other people in the context. And in some ways, it's going to be a discussion that just requires us to balance ourselves in the middle of this very narrow path where if we turn too far to the left, we become these self-absorbed, arrogant egotists. And if we turn to the right too far, we become these self-deprecating people who are focused artificially on altruism. And we don't want to fall off of either of those, in either of those directions, but to stay right in the middle of the path. And so let me explain what I'm getting at. The instigation for the discussion I want to have today or the conversation I want to have today. And I'll just take it from my own experience briefly. A couple of illustrations shortly. Number one, when I played racquetball, and I played racquetball for a long time, loved the sport. I still love the sport. I just don't play anymore. My knees are not good enough. I'm not good enough as a player. But when I did play racquetball, absolutely loved it. I started playing in high school, played through college, through the three decades that followed that, until I moved to Dallas, and then I took up cycling instead. And in racquetball, you know, it's just like tennis, forehands and backhands. I mean, it's not like tennis because it's a lot of wrist movement and, you know, and so on. So the swing is different. But, you know, the game is similar in that way, that it's a racquet sport, and you've got forehands and backhands. And most people are just like most other people. Their backhand is terrible. And so if you can hit it to their forehand, you're going to be hitting to their strength. If you hit their backhand, you might make them weaker. Most people serve to another person's backhand because of it. You say, I didn't want a lesson on racquetball today. Well, I'm almost done. The point is that, of course, my backhand was just like everyone else's. It was pretty bad. And it's weird to swing across your body the way you have to do with the backhand and so on. And so early on, I decided as a racquetball player, when I was in high school, I decided, well, I was going to work on my backhand. And probably for a decade, when I would warm up, when I would just be hitting the ball with myself in the court to get ready for a game, for a match, or if nobody was around to play and all I could do was warm up that day, all I did was practice my backhand. I mean, overhand, down low, whatever. It was backhand, 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 backhand. That's it. And over time, my backhand became the very best part of my game by far, and it was pretty good. I mean, I could whip some people around if I do say so myself, and nobody else is going to say it, so I will. Anyway, I had a great time doing it. I loved racquetball. By the way, enjoyed it with so many different people that became so important in my life, and I'm so grateful for that time. But it was interesting that it was focusing on a weakness that was central to me in order to improve my game. And my forehand just stayed about like it was to begin with. It never became the best forehand in the game, but it wasn't terrible in the process. So in my own mind, I sort of developed this attitude, or I was living it out with that to begin with anyway, that if you have strengths and weaknesses, the thing you need to focus on is your weaknesses, because obviously they're a problem. And so you need to improve your weaknesses. It's the same thing I did when I was in college. And again, I think in both of these cases, it served me well in some senses. And so I think it reinforced it for me. So to me, it seems like an important thing for us to talk about today. For others, it may not. Now, the thing we're going to talk about is the opposite direction. I'm explaining how I got there to realize that I had this thing I needed to address. And so the same thing when I was in college and I majored in math, because I have my mind works in a mathematical way. I'm not a math genius or anything like that, but I just mean when you present me a problem, I want to reduce it to math and I want to solve it with math. That's how I think of things. Even when I'm doing things that don't seem mathematical, reading poetry or studying the scriptures, I'm doing it with structures and I'm trying to create parallelisms, and I want to work with it in the things that can be converted into a formula, because that's what I'm used to. And there are lots of adjustments to have to make to that, so don't take it too simply. But the point is that I started out my college career majoring in math, my undergraduate program, and after a couple of years, 2.5 years, almost 3 years into the math program, when I got past differential equations and into something else, I can't remember what it was, I thought to myself, well, first of all, I thought to myself, this is getting really hard. And then secondly, I thought to myself, and I'm going to be a preacher. Why am I majoring in math? And I'm not very good at the stuff in the English department. Like, I don't like that stuff. And it's not natural for me to sit down and write a paper. And so I changed my major to English because I was weak in that area. And it was also something I needed to develop for the thing that I felt like God had called me to do with my career. So in my own experience, I'm just trying to say, in my own experience, I sort of had a default temperament that said, focus on your weaknesses and let your strengths ride. That's the best way to get along. And in my ministry, I sort of did the same thing. I always had doubts about my interpersonal skills, my ability to relate to other people. I was a little insecure about it, and I'm an introvert to begin with, which is not a good excuse for not relating to people, but sometimes it's a cause. And so I didn't feel like I was very good at that. And so I worked on it. And when you're leading ministry, or when you're doing any kind of ministry, when you're pastoring especially, you have to develop interpersonal skills, you know, or you just don't do it for very long. And so I did. I developed a lot of interpersonal skills, and it served me well, and I'm glad I did. And I had to work hard on it, and I'm grateful for the influence that has had on my life. And if I were to go to the middle from my weakness, as I perceived it, being in interpersonal skills, if I went to the middle of my skills, I would say my spiritual life. I mean, I read the Bible every day. I prayed every day. I did those things. But I also knew that I had to work on it every day, that it would never maintain itself. And so I've always had that sort of demeanor toward spirituality, the spiritual disciplines. That's why they're referred to as spiritual disciplines. I think everybody should probably put those in the middle, except for maybe Mother Teresa when she was alive or somebody like that. The point is that I had doubts about something, so I worked on that. And I had moderate concern about something else, so I worked on that. But I also had total confidence in my, this sounds so arrogant. I don't mean it this way, but I mean, my whole career has been built around this. And so I'm just, I'll just say it. I mean, I can get by with it. My speaking ability, I just knew that I could get up in front of people and speak. In fact, I'm dumbfounded when I think about the fact that for most people, public speaking is their greatest anxiety, that it's like number three in the list of all the anxieties people have in life. That's weird to me, because when somebody says, hey, do you want to speak to this group? I'm like, oh, finally, a group that wants to listen to me. Well, they didn't say they wanted to listen to me. They just said I could speak to them, but that's good enough for me. I love speaking in public, and I always have. I started in eighth grade with a speech to a gathering of our students for some student body election. I didn't even care about running for the student body president. I just wanted to give a speech. You get to give a speech, I'm going to run for that office. And I ran, and it just changed my life. It's like, oh, this is what I've always wanted to do. I love public speaking. So when I debated, I loved the public speaking element of it. When we were doing extemporaneous speaking, I loved the speaking part of it. And so for preaching, for pastoring, for me, getting to prepare a message and then getting up on Sunday morning and speaking and having somewhat of a captive audience, it was just glorious. And so I didn't work on it, didn't need to work on it. I can do public speaking. People are going to pat me on the back out of the way of the church and say, oh, that was a great pastor. That was a great sermon, pastor. At the time, I didn't realize people are just nice. I thought I had actually preached a great sermon, and I could get by with my public speaking. So I didn't work on it at all. I worked on my weaknesses, and I let my speaking just ride. And that was and now I know, I mean, as I look back, I robbed my congregation that was so faithful to me for 17 years. They were just, you know, I was just blessed. They were so faithful. And I did not give them the best that I could have given them. I did not develop the thing that really was the principal reason they were willing to call me as a pastor when I was 24 years old, and that I could have developed into something much better for them. And I have worked on it since then, obviously. But my point in all of that is to say, today, as we have this part of the talk, why it might be important for us as people. And again, and I've had conversations with lots of people who have that same demeanor. I hear them talking about trying to fix this and that about their weaknesses. And what they're doing at the same time, without realizing it, of course, is allowing their strengths to ride because it's good enough. You know, I'm already good enough there. I don't have to prove anything there. I can get by with it the way that it is. And I think that's a confusion in us and a loss for a lot of reasons. Now, and by saying that, I don't mean to say that there's no value in improving weaknesses. There is a value in it. So I don't want to undermine the fact that we can broaden our horizons. For instance, I know there's a value in focusing on your weaknesses and trying to improve yourself in those areas because you can discover unknown strengths. So especially when people are younger or even just entering a new phase of life, you know, whatever it is. So really, honestly, that would mean any time because you can always enter a new phase of life. There is a value to discovering these unknown strengths, and you can do that in a lot of different ways. I mean, one is simply trying something out you haven't tried before and realizing that you have a gift that you didn't know you had. Lo and behold, you can sing. Wow. Have you ever done that before? No, I never sung a song before. You're actually quite good. You need to do more of that. That happens a lot. And so I love that. And that a person would say, yeah, I don't think I can really do that, but I guess I should give it a try just to see. Cool. I think that's fantastic. And there is a value in that. The other way we discover unknown strengths, by the way, is realizing that we've just ignored certain disciplines in life. I mean, not only do we not know the things we don't know, right? But we don't even know sometimes the categories in which we don't know anything. I remember the very first time I took a class that was even related to philosophy, I was already a master's student, a graduate student, and I had never taken a philosophy class. I avoided them. I think my super conservative background had taught me that philosophy was wicked, and you just stay away from those navel-gazing evil people. And they, you know, in some ways, they're not all wrong. But my point is, I avoided it until I was a graduate student and in my late 30s, took the first class where somebody started bringing up some of these philosophical questions that are fundamental about epistemology and ethics and so on. And it was actually an ethics class in my graduate program, not even a philosophy proper type course. But it was enough that I opened my eyes and went, oh my soul, this is where people talk about all that stuff I've been curious about since I was a little kid. I never knew anybody else talked about this stuff. And that was all it took. I mean, my PhD was half in philosophy. I did humanities in the areas of philosophy and history. And it was just, I mean, everything. It was like turning over a brand new leaf every day that I was opening these books. And so there are ignored disciplines that we can discover when we're willing to focus on strengths, on our weaknesses, and trying to improve those. So I think that's worthwhile and great and good. So I'm not trying to disparage all efforts to improve our weaknesses by any stretch of the imagination. It's even important simply to become a better rounded person. That's great. You know, I don't like certain kinds of music, so sometimes I listen to those kinds of music just so I'm, for one, exposed to the ideas that go with certain kinds of music because they are different. Different styles of music bring up different temperaments and attitudes and responses to things that are going on in the world and so on. And sometimes I discover I actually love a kind of music I didn't know that I would love. And I'm pretty surprised by that, as a matter of fact. Anyway, so there's a value in focusing on our weaknesses like that. But on the other hand, there's also the reality that in some ways, even if you focus on a weakness, you're still going to be weak. You know, I took piano lessons for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years when I was a little kid, and I still just clunk keys on a piano. I can make chords. I can make myself learn a whole song, even really sort of complex songs, and get all the notes right. I'm putting that in air quotes, really. And even my air quotes are clunky. But I can't make it into music. I can make it the right rhythm, or I can play the right chords, but I can't turn it into art. My kids, my wife, whew, they can do that. Not me. And I'm okay with that. I get it. I accept it. And, you know, on the other hand, I've got a daughter, for instance, who produces art like you wouldn't believe. I mean, it's amazing. She does mainly pottery type stuff, you know? And I love the stuff that she does. I have a Mobius band on my desk that she made for me. It's magnificent. But I will never produce any piece of visual art that looks like it came from anything vertebrate, much less with any kind of higher brain function. So I just can't do it. I mean, my stick figures look bad. But I'm okay with that. I've learned to accept it, and I did work on it for a while. But then I realized I was just kind of wasting my time. I can't even color within the lines. So there's a point at which we have to acknowledge that none of us are going to be the best at everything. And that if we're only focusing on the things that we're weakest at, then we're neglecting the things we're actually best at. And no matter how good we are at the things we're best at, we have not arrived at perfection in that thing. And so, you know, I guess one of the steps I would take to get there would be to say that if we focus on improving weaknesses, and you only have so many resources, so much time, so much intellectual capacity, so much emotional capacity, you only commit yourself to so much. Focusing on improving weaknesses inherently distracts us from the benefits that would come from focusing on building, developing, sharing our strengths. And then, more importantly, trusting others for the help that our weaknesses expose. And so there are really two beautiful sides to this that have to do with us being able to give the best that we're able to give to others, but also us learning to depend on other people for the best that they're able to give and for the things that we're not able to do well ourselves. So if you think about it in terms of focusing on weaknesses instead of strengths and the problem that creates, you know, in sports, if you have a pitcher, I mean, if I managed a baseball team and I had a pitcher on my team and he spent all of his time in the batting cage, I don't mean throwing at the batting cage. I mean trying to hit the ball in the batting cage. I'd be saying, hey, I really want you to work on your pitching. I mean, I didn't call you here so you'd be a batter. You're here to pitch. You get the idea, right? And so I get it that a person might say, yeah, but I'm already good at pitching. I want to be better at batting. You know, we're going to win games because of how you pitch. And we'll win games because of how that guy bats, but not because of how you bat. And again, I know a pitcher can be a decent hitter, but not very often. You know, it doesn't happen much. Anyway. Exact same thing I would say about all those actors or comedians or whoever it is, you know, who then turn around and want to become a musician, you know? So I'm famous as an actor, therefore my album is worth you buying and listening to my songs. And they may even be good. Sometimes they're decent, you know? I can think of some. I would name some, but I don't want to be picking on people. And I would say, yeah, you know, you can be decent. Maybe you're making decent music, but it wouldn't be music that would cause people to go out and buy your album if it weren't for all the other stuff you did. That doesn't mean that I begrudge them making an album. Their resources, their time, more power to them. I'm happy for people to be able to do all that kind of stuff or to promote their political cause or whatever they want to do. God gave them the ability to do it. Go do it. That's fine. But I would say the more you're focusing on that, the less you're focusing on the things that actually made you so important to the community around you, to the people around you, that they were willing to put up with your caterwauling when you wanted to sing as well. That's a harsh way to put it, isn't it? Okay, so anyway, you get the idea. So what I would say in application this does to me is say, you know, so like we've become so focused on being independent, not needing other people. I am my own man. Even if we talk about wealth, the thing that makes wealth sufficient is the word independent. He's independently wealthy. We've become so focused on being independent, and I mean this in practical terms, in simple terms, for all of us, that we've lost the value of interdependence. We've forgotten what it was all about. Back in the late 80s, maybe the early 90s, can't remember exactly the year this term came out in an article that I read at the time when I was pastoring. The term came out, cocooning, as a way of describing this social change that was taking place, that people were more and more never coming out of their home, that they were ordering pizza in their home, and they were ordering materials that they would read at home. And some people were even, 80s and 90s, working from home. It was just insane. Anyway, you get the idea. You can imagine how much more that is now. If we had even dreamed that Amazon would do what they do now and would say to you, you don't even have to come to the door. We'll just leave it at the door. For heaven's sake, you don't have to shake hands with anybody. You don't have to see anybody. We'll ring your doorbell and let you know about it. Or if you don't want us to ring your doorbell, we'll just let your Amazon assistant tell you that we left it at your door. It's cocooning. So you build a cocoon around yourself and you make it so that you don't have to interact with anyone. And you can imagine how much more we're doing that now than we were then. And I'm talking about going to the grocery store and not having to even talk to a cashier everything. Go to the gas station, for heaven forbid, you'd have to walk inside and talk to the guy behind the counter. We don't do any of that. So we've cocooned ourselves in cocoons that have wheels so that we can get to the cocoons that don't have wheels so that we can stay away from all the people who are in their cocoons. And if you ever walk around your neighborhood, unless your neighborhood has lots of dogs, you're never going to meet the people who are a part of your neighborhood because they're cocooned up in their houses. I'm not being critical of people for that. I'm just saying that's sort of what we've become as a society. Just how we are. We love our independence. Why have we done that? Why did cocooning become a trend? And it's really simple, because connection requires adjustment. If you connect with other people, you have to adjust. You have to adjust your schedule so that you can meet up with them, or you have to adjust your vocabulary so that you don't offend them. Think of all the ways we've used the term political correctness to say how offensive it is that we would have to adjust our language because of those stupid feelings other people have. That's an adjustment because you want to connect. So connections require adjustment, and just in terms of basic definitions, adjustment means compromising your total freedom. That's what adjustment means. I had to adjust. I was going to go that way, but I'm going to go this way. I was going to zig. I'm going to zag because of somebody being over there. What a nuisance. And freedom is our independence. So because we want to avoid giving up our freedom, we give up our connections. This is what we do. It's not complicated. I don't think it's magical. I can't imagine. I mean, a million people have surely said this by now. You realize on the inverse of that, we could just as easily realize that independence is a limitation. You know, the idea of independence, you know, is giving up a trade with other countries, if you're talking about your nation's independence. It's giving up companionship for individuals. I have my independence. Yeah, you do. And who are you telling about that? You know, you got nobody around you. But making adjustments makes room for those connections that we were trying to avoid to maintain our independence, right? So independence becomes a limitation because if we're not willing to make those connections, to make those adjustments that give us those connections, then we don't have the ability to come to a better life. So independence is itself a limitation on having a better life because connections give us a better life. This is not complicated. Other people make better food than you do, unless you are the chef. Other people serve you. I mean, literally, like, you have to adjust to be in a place where somebody can get access to your toenails to do your, what's it called? Pedicure. Yeah, I don't get pedicures, but I'm just saying, some people want pedicures. But you know what? You have to adjust if you're going to get a pedicure. Weird example, I admit it. But art, spirituality, everything The statement in Scripture, iron sharpens iron, doesn't mean we don't need adjustment, right? And that requires other people. So it's kind of a shame that we've given all that up. Why do I bring that up today? Because, you know, the point is that there is a value that we can bring to other people, and it's not to bring to them our weakest offerings. It's to bring to them our best offerings, our strengths. And there is a value that we receive from other people when they bring to us their strengths, which we're only going to be willing to receive if we acknowledge that we have some weaknesses. I don't need your music. I mean, goat rodeo people. I don't need to listen. You know the goat rodeo, right? That's some good music. So I don't need to listen to your music. I'm taking up cello myself. I mean, who needs Yo-Yo Ma? Yeah, so you get the idea of what I'm talking about, right? It's the same with spiritual gifts. This is not different. If I look at, you know, Romans 12, the statements there, for by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. This is, you know, you're not, we're not the end all and be all of existence. It's all about me. You can't do it yourself. But to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. And then he goes on to describe how that measure of faith plays out in the body of Christ by saying we all have different elements that we bring to it, right? So as in one body, we have many members, and the members don't all have the same function. So we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members one of another, having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us. And I'm not here to talk about spiritual gifts today. I'm just creating a parallel, an analogy with what it is in life in the things that we're doing. I know spiritual gifts are what God gives us so we can serve the body. And they have to do with what the needs of the body are and so on. So I'm not comparing spiritual gifts with our strengths or the things that we do best in that way, but simply to say, in the same way that God gives different gifts to different parts of the body of Christ, so that we can then bless and strengthen each other and bring those best strengths to each other, in that same way, he's put us together as a society to do exactly the same thing in our relationships with each other. And you can find the same thing in 1 Corinthians 12. We're celebrating the differences between us in this way. And so the other benefit, so in one sense, I'm saying to you, if you look at yourself and say, well, you know, I have this one thing that I can do that I'm pretty good at, but I want to do all that other stuff. I appreciate that. I understand that. I naturally sort of empathize with that. But that one thing that you're really good at, and I'm not talking about in the body of Christ now, I mean in society as a whole, that one thing that you're really good at is the most valuable thing you bring to the society because you're really good at it and offering that in some way. I'm not saying you have to. I'm not twisting your arm behind your back and saying, oh, now the Communist Committee has decided that you're going to go to this kind of school and have this kind of education. I'm not saying that. I'm saying to you personally, in the decisions that you make and the things you choose to prioritize, that coasting on the thing you're best at, instead of driving that thing toward the best it can be in you, might be keeping others from benefiting in the best way they could from your participation in their life, from the role you play in their community, in your community with them. And that's true. But the other benefit that goes with it is that when we focus on the strengths that we have, we make room for relying on the strengths that other people have. And, you know, that way, by focusing on it, we have to learn to rely on other people for the things at which we're not the best anyway. It's the same thing Adam Smith is teaching in economics in terms of specialization. I won't focus on that very long at all. In fact, I'll just skip right through it. But you know what I'm talking about in The Wealth of Nations, a book that underpins some of the basic concepts of economics that we follow to this day. And I know the significant revisions that we give to it in the 19th and 20th centuries and blah, blah, blah. But the point, or in the 20th century especially. But the point is, it's still the case that specialization, I'm good at this, you're good at that, I'll focus on this, that way I'll contribute to the economy in the best way I can, is a really fundamental concept, not just of free market economics, but just the nature of economic functioning. And when Wilhelm von Humboldt, and I think this is a better illustration of what I'm talking about, gives us the book, The Limits of State Action. This is back in 1792 or somewhere around there. I didn't look up the exact date, but he wrote it in the late 1700s, around 1792, because it was after the French Revolution. So you'd had a couple of revolutions, and the idea of monarchy was falling aside, and then the concept of what the state would do and wouldn't be able to do and how government would be formed and what the social structure would look like was up in the air. They were trying to figure it out. And a huge part of what he wanted to focus on is the value that personal liberty gives to the best that a society can be. That is, and a lot of libertarians, by the way, I think the Libertarian Press is the thing that puts out this book, The Limits of State Action, whatever the Libertarian Press is called. And the idea was to say this, that the government should not choose what people are going to be taught. By the way, much later, I think he became the head of public education in Prussia or something like that. So it's ironic that he would do that because he basically said there shouldn't be public education because in the sense that it's dictated by the government, because then you're restricting people to the shape or form that the government has in mind for them rather than the things they're naturally curious about. It sounds almost Montessori, doesn't it? But if you let people focus on the things they're really good at and develop those and then choose the things that are going to be the skills they give themselves to in life and so on, then you end up with people doing the very best thing they can do to contribute to that society. You can hear libertarian strains throughout all of those statements, and there is something sensible about it. I do have a libertarian streak in me. It's a really thick one, and I value it. I think there is important value to be given to respecting that desire that people have to do the very best they can do with the thing they're best at. And so society benefits best from you, this is the idea behind that, when you're providing the things you're best at. And you benefit from relying on people in society who are better at a variety of things than you could ever be, even if you chose to focus on them. You know, when I was, and I haven't talked much about this before, but I've gotten better at being able to handle it emotionally, so we'll give it a try here. When I was at my dad's funeral, so yeah, I can get there. So when we planned the memorial service, I'm blessed to have all four of my kids are unbelievably talented, gifted. I'm not just saying that as a proud parent. I would say it just as a proud parent, but I mean, objectively, they're just really good at a lot of things. And I'm blessed by that and encouraged by that. But, my two sons in particular have given themselves to music. They are great at it. The music that we use on this show is a product of my oldest son, by the way. Both of my sons are just, they're amazing at music, and that's their thing. That's what they do. And they're well received in doing it. And so anyway, because they make music, we asked them to perform, to lead some music for the memorial service for my dad when he died. And so, when they did it, I was just dumbfounded by the quality of the music. And I've done ministry for a long time. And so I've done a lot of funeral services and been involved in a lot of worship services, a lot of events that required music, weddings and funerals and all that kind of stuff too. And it was maybe the best music I've ever heard at a memorial service. And again, I may be prejudiced, but even if I'm not prejudiced, I think objectively it was some of the best music I've ever heard at a memorial service. And it's because they've given themselves to music. I could never do that. I could desire it as much as I want. I could want to do it as much as I want, and I could never make the music that they made. Even if I practiced for 20 years, it's just not in me the way it's in them. It's a piece of art for them. And between the emotion and the music and the performance itself and the attitude they had with each other and the humility they brought out of respect to my dad, all of that, it was just magnificent. And I'm so glad that I was able to hand to someone else the responsibility to choose the songs and make the music and decide how they were going to perform it and then to actually do it. Instead of thinking, well, I'm just going to put on the best I can do because I spoke at the memorial service. I did the part that I was supposed to do. But I think it was so much better because we relied on different people to do the things they were best at. And so focusing on strengths, makes several things possible, which would otherwise simply vanish into oblivion. And this is me saying to you, I know you may, if you're still listening, first of all, I'm surprised, but I'm glad. But if you are still listening, you might be thinking, oh, well, whatever. I mean, somebody who has strength, that's what they should focus on. But I don't think you get how much we're this way. If you're good enough at something that other people aren't correcting you about it, your tendency is going to be to let it lie. You just, it's good enough. I'm not going to improve that anymore. I've read enough about that. I know enough about that. I've told students who are studying scriptures, you know, when do you think you've figured out a passage? And they'll say, you know, when I've studied it and answered all the questions. And I say, answered all the questions or just answered the ones you were asking at the moment? Because when we're satisfied is when we've just gotten enough that it's good enough, that we're not concerned about it anymore. And not being concerned about it anymore stops our curiosity and we stop learning. It's what made C.S. Pierce's version of pragmatism a philosophy that would come to dominate America. And I mean it in a good way. He recognized that when you stop doubting, you stop learning. And what I'm suggesting is that some of you are so good at what you do and it's so natural to you that you don't doubt that anymore. You know you're going to be able to do it. And I'm guilty of this on a lot of things. Not a lot of things. I'm not good at a lot of things. But I'm guilty about it on some things. And I don't want to be that way on whatever it is. I don't want to say, I know the Bible well enough. I guess I'm done. I don't want to say, I speak well enough. I guess I'm done. I don't want to be a person who says, I've covered that passage. I know that answer. That's good enough. That class is good enough. I don't need to add any more to it. I don't need to study it again or rewrite it or re-prepare it. I don't want to be that way. I don't want to bring people slop. I don't think God put me here so that I would do that. And I don't think he put you here so we would do that. And so I am talking to you to say those things that you think are good enough and you don't need to figure out anymore. Maybe those are the things you can go back to and say, how could I make that even better? How could I make it so that this is something I could offer to other people at an even higher level to make more of a difference for them? And doing that allows us to provide some things that otherwise just vanish. One, and this one doesn't happen to everybody, doesn't need to happen to everybody, but one, real genius emerges from that. The idea that a Descartes in his 40s would finally come to have time to put aside all the other things that were occupying him, including making a living, which is necessary, and be able to really focus on his philosophy to produce some works that have changed the world. You know, that doesn't happen if you don't focus on the things that are your strengths. I could say it about so many things. You know, as the president of a college, I think about it in terms of our mission. When we focus on what makes Criswell College what it is, the thing that sets us apart, then we do something that changes our community in the best way we can have an influence on it. And if instead we just tried to become everything that everybody else is doing to make a living and to expand the college and to have more attendance and all that kind of stuff, you know, we just sort of fall into the slough of mediocrity. And that's not what we're about. So in one sense, it allows for these world-changing, unique influences to emerge. In another sense, in a second sense, it also provides the community with the benefit of the very best that you have to offer. So when we focus on developing the things at which we're best, we are often creating the best opportunity to strengthen or bless our communities. And I can give different examples about this. I won't focus on it. I'm not saying that somebody has a right to demand from you the best that you have to give, other than God. But I am saying you may have an obligation to provide for them the very best thing that you can offer. As we think about ethical responsibilities, right, we think in prima facie duties. I've talked about William David Ross on this program on a previous episode. And the ideas of promise keeping and gratitude and reparations and under generosity, the ideas of sharing and beneficence and then self-improvement, non-maleficence, both beneficence and self-improvement, you know, beneficence, doing good, making a difference for other people that's good, intervening in a way that brings help. And then self-improvement, they kind of go hand in hand. And in what we're talking about right now, that's what we're describing. That your opportunity to serve other people in the very best way you can serve them may be best manifested by focusing on the things at which you're already best but could be even better with a little focus. So again, sometimes the best thing you can do for others is use the best thing you're able to do for them. But then the third thing, and this is the reason I wanted to have the conversation, and I'll close with it. The third thing it does is force us to depend on others who in turn offer their strengths to us because we're acknowledging that we have weaknesses. And sure, I'll work on it some, but I still need help where I have weaknesses. And studying or practicing or focusing or applying our best can be a means of turning what could be self-centered into the gift or even sacrifice you offer to the people that God has put into your community, but that turns around and allows them to do the same for you. So in other words, committing to your best with your best can be a good way to love your neighbor, the very best way you know how to love them. It also says to them, to someone you want to trust you, that you trust them. And because our greatest strength, remember I said our greatest strength can lead to our greatest weakness? You know, focusing on your strengths can reveal your weakness. But what does revealing your weakness do? It reveals what our greatest strength was to begin with. Our greatest strength is what comes together when we come together with the people God uses to make us better. That's how we love our neighbors. That's how we love one another.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.